Welcome back to the Gains for Girls podcast. As I've said on this podcast many times before, we have very few coaches or presidents in this case who are willing to stand up. We had Dave and his wonderful wife, Judy Brown, on recently. They were coaches who were willing to protest the inclusion of males into women's sports. But Larry Mail, he is the president of USA Powerlifting, and he has gone as far now to even file a lawsuit. Because he understands the harm and the severity that his athletes, his female athletes, his power lifters are facing when males are invited and allowed and encouraged to participate in women's powerlifting. I could not be more inspired by him. We have done several things together, including press conferences, ultimately urging the NCAA, the Biden administration, the IOC to revisit their policies and to protect women. Check out our interview here. Larry, thank you so much for joining the Gains for Girls podcast. You and I have gotten to know each other a little bit over the past year or so, of course, in this advocacy role. But I wanted you to start by telling us a little bit about your background, because I was researching, you know, you as a person before the podcast, and I had no idea, knowing you for the past year or whatever it's been, I had no idea you accomplished all the things that you have in your own personal life and career. So tell us a little bit about your background, how you got to the position you are now.
Well, professionally, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. I've been practicing, I guess, about 40 years now. Currently, I work in an adolescent inpatient facility. I work primarily with adolescent girls. I've done a lot of different things over the course of my career, from being the director of forensic evaluation for the state of Alaska, and a psychologist on active duty. And probably most importantly, though, I've been involved in powerlifting for coming up on 50 years now. And having done that, I've done a number of things. I'm currently the president of USA Powerlifting. I'm in, I think, my sixth term. It's hard to remember exactly. But also probably importantly as well, I've coached 57 internationals. I was the coach of the women's national team for 13 years. And I coached a team of women from Alaska that won the national championship 7 out of 8 years in running. So wow. I have background both in psychology, but also in powerlifting and in coaching directly.
Well, that's amazing. Of course, we have seen some pretty big policy change in the powerlifting world. I think a lot of people have been following along with the fighting world in general as these sports where these differences between male and women, you would think they are the most obvious and where they matter the most. So I wanted to get your take. You know, again, I don't think it takes a scientist or someone with your background to see these differences. But what specifically do these biological differences between the sexes, what do they look like in the sport of powerlifting, and why do they matter?
Well, they matter in powerlifting, and we tried to approach it, obviously, from our various backgrounds, those of us who researched it, and our knowledge of the sport and our experience of the sport. And as I said, I was the women's national team coach for a period of time, but I've also coached male world champions, so I have a fairly good read of what the differences are. But to look at it legitimately, you have to ask a series of questions. And the first of them is, are men and women really different in powerlifting? And we looked at 17,000 cases worldwide. And what we found is that men are more than 60% stronger than women. And no disservice to women. It's just a different physiology and plays out differently in sports. And for that reason, we have sex-based categories. The gulf is enormous in powerlifting.
I like that you mention it doesn't make one sex inferior to the other. It just makes us different in a way that not only, of course, should be acknowledged, but really in a way that should be celebrated. And the 60% performance gap, that is so much larger than other sports. You take swimming, for example, and if you look at the world record holder in, let's say,
the 200 backstroke on the women's side versus the world record holder in the 200 backstroke on the men's side, that performance gap is 10 to 12%, which of course is still a very large margin. But again, just for context of how large a 60% performance gap really is. The International Powerlifting Federation, what is the policy that they have in place right now?
Their policy currently, in some ways, mirrors the IOC policy, but it's somewhat more restrictive. And it's a testosterone-based policy that essentially says if you reduce your testosterone, in their case, to 2.4 nanomoles per milliliter, basically, a fairly low level, and you maintain it for a period of time, then you may compete in the women's division. Adjunctive to that are that you must apply, but you must provide medical records, and you are ultimately responsible for documenting that your testosterone level hasn't risen above that level. It mirrors the IOC policy to some degree. It's a little bit more restrictive, but it's still a testosterone-based policy.
So it reduces women down to being a testosterone level. And speaking of the Olympics and the sport of lifting, powerlifting, we saw Laurel Hubbard. Really, I would say this is one of the first cases that really gained national attention surrounding the inclusion of males in women's sports. Laurel Hubbard is, of course, a weightlifter from New Zealand who is a male, but who got to compete on the women's team in the 2016 or 2020 Olympics?
I think probably the incident or the competitive experience you're talking about is 2016, and that was in Anaheim, California. I was actually present for that.
I can imagine watching in real time what this looked like. But under the Olympics guidelines and framework now, which I've read, which are atrocious, the framework that they have in place. Do you know that the framework they have in place, the IOC, again, the International Olympic Committee, of course, this is the framework they resort other governing bodies like the IPF to resort to when making their rules. It says male advantage cannot be presumed over women. It says that male advantage is perceived, unverified, and alleged. And until we can prove males have advantages over females, then it would be wrong to discriminate on the basis of transgender status.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. There's an article that came out this week in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Sports, and it took on some of those assumptions of the IOC. And there are several takeaways from that, but one of them is that there's, as you said, no presumption that men and women are stronger. And that really goes to the heart of the fact that this really fails in terms of common sense. And, you know, to make maybe what's a silly analogy, you don't have to have scientific studies to realize that if you drive your motorcycle into the wall at 60 miles an hour, you're probably going to be killed.
Oh.
And the same thing applies here. It doesn't take years of scientific study to notice that men and women are different in sport. And the IOC fostering that, they've done that in several ways, but fostering that really flies in the face of credibility on their part, I think.
Absolutely. Well, you have been one of the first people of prominence in the sporting world, especially as a president, the president of USA Powerlifting, to ultimately take a stand in defending female athletes, women in general. And you filed a lawsuit. I want you to be able to explain what this lawsuit is, and of course, an update on how things stand now.
Sure. It's really been a long process for us, and I really would go back to 2015. At that point, I was on the IPF medical committee, and our policy was that trans women couldn't compete in the women's division. By virtue of politics, they softened that and and essentially catered to the IOC and changed that policy. But the medical committee, in fact, they removed several of us because of our stance on that policy. But that was the original policy, really 8 or 9 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And USA Powerlifting, as the affiliate of the IPF at that time, adopted that policy. We didn't do so basically naively or in a way to just accept their logic. Rather, we looked at the issue really at some depth and consulted experts. I mentioned the issue of looking at a large pool of lifters. We did that, but we went beyond that. And you always in science have to ask why questions. Why does it make a difference? And we have access to youth data. We have a youth program. It starts at 8 years of age, and we break it up into 2-year increments. And so if our working hypothesis was, if you transition through puberty as a male, that makes a significant difference, we should see that in the data. And in fact, we did. At 8 and 9 years of age, there really is not a lot of difference between males and females in powerlifting. But at 10 and 11, there's a pretty big difference. It's more than 20%. And at 12 and 13 years old, it approaches the adult levels of difference. So puberty matters. Maturation in what is essentially a testosterone bath matters. So that was our policy, basically. J.C. Cooper initially filed a human rights complaint in Minnesota, and we went through that process for about 2 years, with the end idea that we would have a fair hearing and get to present some evidence and talk
and
about
tell us
settlement.
Very briefly, is J.C. Cooper is a male identifying as a woman, correct?
Yes, we refer to her as a trans woman because at the end of the day, we don't care.
Right.
You can call yourself whoever you want to, but how you mature matters to us, and how you perform within the context of male-female difference matters to us. Very much so, especially in powerlifting. Ms. Cooper withdrew that suit and filed in the district court in Ramsey County, Minnesota, where we have been going through this process for several years now. The judge issued a summary judgment against us and essentially denied us due process. Our experts were denied. We were denied a chance of a hearing. We were denied a trial. And on that basis, we appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And as you're probably aware, they rendered their decision not long ago. And in that decision, they affirmed the stance that we argued, that there may be non-discriminatory reasons for excluding trans women from the women's division, that we were denied the opportunity to present our evidence before a jury, and affirmed, and this is probably a minor point, that USA Powerlifting Minnesota is not a separate entity where the individuals may be sued individually, but is a function of USA Powerlifting nationally. So in essence, they affirmed on every point that we appealed on. We will head back to the district court for the trial that we should have had, or the opposing counsel will appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. It's still their call. We're just waiting to hear.
Well, it seems like to a degree, of course, the battle is far from won, but it seems like to a degree, common sense is prevailing, which is never a given, considering we live in a world where common sense is not common. But that's a huge win. And in the meantime, of course, and we will be following along, cheering you on. And again, really thanking you for the stance and the fight that you've shown for women and, again, for biological reality. But I've got to ask you, we've had April Hutchinson on the podcast before. I know you know April. She is the powerlifter from Canada who has been outspoken about males competing in women's powerlifting, taking opportunities away from her, roster spots, you know, podium spots. She's wonderful, and she's been incredibly fierce on this topic and someone who really inspires me. But I've got to get your take on the CPU, the Canadian Powerlifting Union, and what they're doing, because still to this day, I mean, April has faced suspension. She has faced all kinds of animosity thrown her way by the people who are in charge, the authority figures there. Of course, other powerlifters, both male and female, critiquing her for her stance. So what's your take, of course, on the CPU, but also, I think more importantly, the silencing efforts that they're going through to keep powerlifters like April quiet?
Well, I think the CPU situation is interesting, and it's somewhat the Canadian character to kind of go along and get along, and probably at least in a little bit, that's what's going on with the CPU. But the CPU has taken the IPF policy and taken it further, and their policy is one of full inclusion, now with the exception of national and international events, because they must enforce the IPF policy, which is more restrictive. But I think that recent events, as recent as February, really exemplify what the CPU is doing. And in a recent meet in British Columbia, a trans woman competed in the women's division after having been disallowed from strong woman, and essentially crushed the competition. And in the CPU, apparently that's okay. I would point out as well that it looks like there's some differential treatment of April versus the other people on the other side of the issue, who really have spoken at will, called transphobia and called people bigots, and made really threatening comments, which April doesn't appear to have done at any level. And she is in fact suspended. So it looks differential to me. And that, on the part of a sporting federation, is disturbing at the least.
Yeah, and at any level, you know, if this were going the other way, it would still be disturbing. But as you said, that's sounds like Canada for you. But I'm curious, a question I've been curious for you, you know, working specifically with women, again, taking the stance that you have, what are some of the kind of private conversations? I mean, do you have girls who thank you for the stance that you've taken? Is it, I guess what I'm asking is, the private conversations, are they different than the public forward-facing conversations and the debate that we see maybe in the media? Is that different for you?
Yes, clearly it is. And I hear very frequently, sometimes by social media, sometimes by email, from women who just say thank you. But more frequently, because I go to all the national meets and dozens of meets every year, women approach me personally to discuss the issue and talk about it. And so my sense is that women powerlifters have very strong feelings about it, but they also feel like they've been silenced, that they will be subject to abuse. They will be subject to legal action if they in fact make public statements reflecting that. And there are exceptions, of course. Some of the women competitors don't care about the potential consequences, but many of them do. And that's especially true for elite women powerlifters who potentially faced a loss of sponsorship and
their
competition opportunities.
Yeah, it's how they put food on the table. Oftentimes it's what I've seen in other sports like cycling, some other niche sports, even like pool, eight ball, or darts, even we've seen recently. And talking to these women, of course they know it's wrong and they feel harmed by this, but they're scared to say something, and understandably so, because of the threats they might face, and as you mentioned, ultimately losing out on funds or sponsorships. Or they see what happens to April, and that is certainly a deterrent. What advice do you have for other leaders in sports, other men or women who are in your same position, who have the authority and the influence and the platform to defend their athletes?
Well, I think that my advice would be following with what we've done, and without the data, without a meaningful look at your sport and looking at the differences, but also, as is consistent with the article that just came out with this week, you need to survey your constituents. You need to know what the differences are. You need to be able to make decisions on those data and stay the course. But you also need to know what the sentiments of your particular athletes are. And I think if given the opportunity to respond anonymously, I think that they would really hear what the majority of their competitors really think versus what they feel like they're able to say publicly.
I love that. You're basically saying, give your athletes a seat at the table, which is what I wish more leaders would do. I wish it's what the NCAA would do. I wish it's what the IOC would do. I wish it's what the Biden administration would do. But unfortunately, that seems to be not the direction that we're going. Although I do certainly believe that the tide is turning. Last thing for you. I know you live in Alaska, which is cold. Last time I was there, granted, I was there in like November or December. There was like 3 or 4 feet of snow on the ground. Alaska is now introducing, it's HB 183. It is their bill that would protect, of course, the sports on the basis of sex, ensuring that there are two categories. I just testified in Alaska. As you can imagine, I was told that I have no decorum. I have blood on my hands. There was even one Republican member. I was so baffled by this. There was one Republican member who said we should just eliminate the categories of sport altogether, to which I just wanted to respond to him. Okay, do you think we should eliminate age categories? Do you think we should eliminate fighting sports like boxing or like the MMA? Should we eliminate weight classes? Should we eliminate the Paralympics versus the Olympics? What a silly comment for him to make. Very briefly, what's your message to these representatives who are soon to vote on this bill, hoping that they do the right thing and vote in support of HB 183?
As you know, probably from your experiences up there, Alaska is a pretty right-leaning state. And so I would say this, by the way, I probably know who that Republican politician was. But I would say this, the Department of Education has already released regulations in Alaska for high school sports that define women's categories as being those who are born that way. So administratively, there's a great deal of push, but I would say that as in much of the country, they need to look out there at their constituents, because the people who live beyond Anchorage are probably not going to buy it, and that they should vote with their constituents, which if they would take the time to talk to them, which I am obviously one, they would see that there's strong sentiment for protecting women's sports in Alaska.
Absolutely. As I would imagine every other state, even these states that aren't conservative leaning. But Larry, you are the best. I admire you. I think every president, I think every CEO, even taking this past sports and into corporate America, I think every athletic director, coach should watch this and be inspired by you just like I am. It really is amazing to see someone, despite the consequences, despite the fear, the backlash that you certainly face, do the right thing, do what's fair, and do what's sensible. Just as you said, listening to your athletes, that's what your job is. That's what your job is. So we could not be more grateful for you, and I appreciate you for coming on. And we will certainly be following your lawsuit.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the podcast today. Make sure you're following along Larry's lawsuit. Of course, this would set the precedent for a lot of sports, a lot of people, and ultimately stating that biological reality matters. And not only does it matter, it's urgent that we enforce it. Thanks for following. Make sure you like, subscribe anywhere where you get your podcast. You can check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Check us out at outkick.com, and we will see you again next week.